This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, welcome to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Julian Ng. We have a lineup today that, depending on how you look at it, could be either exciting, awesome, stimulating, or just important to listen to. I mean, it could be a range of things. I've just been banned by Julian for saying exciting.
No, it was just a suggestion.
It's a great suggestion. But when you're repetitive, you're unlikely to be exciting, don't you think?
I think you're right.
Mind you, some pleasures are worth repeating, I think.
Many pleasures are worth repeating on and on again.
Perhaps that's the very definition of pleasure.
That you can repeat.
And that you want, that you desire to repeat.
Yes,
so, okay,
absolutely.
There you have it.
You're crossing the red line, Sharad. The red line has been something that's very much used over the weekend, right, with those Syrian bombings. But anyway.
But think about chocolates. Chocolate's something you want to return to over and over again.
For sure.
Okay. So as per normal, we have the breakfast grill today. And our guest is Nicola Padfield. She's the master of Fitzwilliam College in Cambridge. She's a British barrister and academic. She's current master of Fitzwilliam College, as I said, and she was appointed in 2003. She's a reader in criminal and penal justice at the Faculty of Law, the University of Cambridge. In fact, one of her areas of study is rape laws, and in particular, laws pertaining to sexual violence against children. So that's going to be one of the many questions I'm going to ask her. I'm also am very interested in Fitzwilliam College setting up a foundation, or a fund rather, named after the late Lee Kuan Yew. Mm-hmm. And so that's also going to be a subject of some of our conversations.
Are you going to talk about the Tasik Lugo MP's imbroglio, which she came out to clarify a few days ago about the fact that his statement was taken out of context?
Yeah, he said it was. I think the press has come back to say, well, we have the exact recordings of what he said. He said, you know, sometimes when they said taken out of context, maybe in his mind he was making distinctions that he didn't actually utter. And so one of the things that he said he was referring to was not non-consensual or violent rape, but consensual, but one involving a minor. So you know, the question of statutory rape, where there might have been some sort of relationship between the two individuals.
Yeah, I think whenever your own statements are taken out of context is usually your fault, because you have to be so careful about what you say, especially if you are a public personality and you're out there making statements every day. You have to really send out the correct message. As when we go on air, we can't just utter words when we go on air, right?
Yeah, we have to be very thoughtful.
Sometimes we do. Sometimes
everybody doesn't.
But when something is taken out of context, especially when it causes such an uproar, then we know that we have crossed certain lines and we've got to be really careful about it.
I think with this is that it's shocking to think that he didn't anticipate the backlash.
Yes.
Considering all the discussions we've had about sexual violence against women and children of the last couple of years, and some horrendous cases that we also have been reported. And so you think, well, you know, if you're going to step into this rather tricky area of public policy, then you have to be very, very clear about what you mean. And so if he had a complex argument to support his contention that it might actually be a solution for victims of rape to marry their rapists, then he didn't do that well enough. I mean, he clearly didn't.
I think the Koreans and the Japanese would offer a very elegant way out, which is just to go out there and publicly apologize instead of digging a bigger hole for yourself, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, this is what a lot of public personalities perhaps are loath to do. But even us in the media, but there's also some standard practices. When you've made a mistake, you correct it and you admit to it and you move on.
You better not say more, otherwise you'll be sued for just taking things out of context again. But he's threatened to sue the press.
Oh, really? Well, very good. Good for him. Because I do think that and I don't mean that in kind of a sarcastic way. I mean, I think that if you have been taken out of context, then you should have legal remedies, for some sort of redress, at least, to protect your own reputation. But, at the same time, I guess we don't really want a litigious society where people are suing each other left.
This is probably a subject that we could explore on future 6 AMs because I'm beginning to sort of turn over to the other side in America they're a very litigious society, and I think it might just help the rights of people who don't have enough funding to take up lawsuits.
Right? Okay. Well, we'll come to that later on because we're going to be talking about that Warner Brothers story where the makers of The Conjuring, or at least the two characters, the two individuals on whose lives and notes The Conjuring movie series is supposedly based, are being sued. So they're being sued.
This is the movie that has been made by that Malaysian, right? The Conjuring.
No. This is an American movie.
Yeah.
Is it made by an American? By a Malaysian?
A Malaysia is behind that.
Oh, really?
James Wan.
Oh, okay.
Directed by James Wan. Okay. He's Malaysian. I know that. We always try to appropriate the identities of all these people who have gone over there to do their work.
Malaysian
I claim them as Malaysian. But yes, he is of Malaysian roots.
Yeah. Tsai Ming-liang, a Sarawakian who's done very well in the Taiwanese film world. And then, of course, then globally, he's won awards and he's been at Cannes and stuff.
Yeah, and over the weekend as well, I think I made an update on my Facebook status about the 17-year-old girl with Malaysian roots who got accepted to all the Ivy League universities in America. And I put her essay on my Facebook update, and my friends were actually saying that, we shouldn't claim her as Malaysian because she's practically not Malaysian. Well, she's been living there
since she was five.
For a long time.
Yeah. But so it's interesting about the successes that people with some connection to Malaysia have. In fact, during that story came along with another story of this Bangladeshi kid, Bangladeshi-American kid, who's also done very well, gotten into Ivy League. And both of them, seem to be really... and this is, I think, very important for a lot of parents to understand that... your kid gets accepted into these stellar institutions because they're well-rounded individuals. It's not just because they got the A's,
Yes, and not just because they're of Malaysian heritage.
Well, certainly not for that, but certainly because they're well-rounded. So that Bangladeshi kid was very interesting because at 14 he declared himself an activist, and went out there and really took up many issues. Most parents here would see this as a liability, like don't become an activist, don't get involved in anything.
That's true.
Just study, And Julian, it was very interesting. At the Health and Living event that we had on Saturday,
over the weekend.
I had an individual came up to me and he started talking to me about his daughter and how he encouraged her to take a gap year before she started university. And she took 2 years off and did all kinds of very interesting things. And as a result, she's doing so well at university. And he was saying that, and he's a very proud father. I mean, he's filled with pride about his daughter's successes. And he says he thinks, despite all the people around him saying, don't send, this is a waste of 2 years. Your daughter will be, set back 2 years, and then all that. And then he says, no, it was such a valuable, she went to university as a mature individual. And that's really paid dividends.
I think one of the complaints that are usually leveled at Malaysian students is that we are too bookish, right? We always go by the books and we don't have that outside experience and we don't have the communication skills, which can only be attained if you go out there and actually talk to people and have those sorts of experiences. Maybe this gap year solution is something that's desirable for our students.
Yeah, in fact, you know, I was also over the weekend talking to somebody involved in, you know, recruiting students into medical programs, and she was saying to me that, you know, you'll get a cohort, everybody's got straight A's. So how do you choose between, you know, the many individual candidates mm-hmm. who are coming to, you know, for entry into medical school? And she says it really is about maturity. You know, they can set them on any kind of test, but it's really the test around ethics. It's the fact that they have extracurricular activities and they are well-rounded individuals that gets them into medical school, not just the A's. But we're obsessed in this country with A's. So the A's seem – the marks themselves seem to to be sufficient, at least in the public discourse, around yeah. you know, who is really an high achiever.
Yeah, and if you look at the essay that I posted up on my Facebook, written by Cassandra Xiao, who submitted that particular essay to all those Ivy League universities, it's really something that's very beautiful because it's not academic in nature. She was telling a story about how English was spoken in her household in America, and they are of East Malaysian roots, and so they pronounce certain words differently from how the actual let alone the actual English, American English, right? Let alone that even for West Malaysians, the East Malaysian way of intonation is so different. And she was telling that particular story, and it was a beautiful, inspiring, interesting story that was not academic. And that was what was interesting about it, and it reflected a person who could capture these nuances. And I think that reflected her intelligence as well.
Absolutely. And she was handsomely rewarded by getting all these offers for undergraduate studies, wasn't she?
Maybe we should put this up on Twitter.
We could. If you give me the link, I will send it around. I didn't know you were like a major Facebook person, Julian.
No, I wasn't. I'm very discriminating in what I put
up
there.
Oh, my goodness. So you should want to friend Julian then.
Once, maybe in 3 months, I put something
I've
up.
I've completely fallen off Facebook. Okay, moving on current affairs, which comes after the 8:30 news, we have Goh Siew Lin. She's the president of the Association of Women Lawyers of Malaysia, explaining why marital rape should be included in the penal code. So I think there's an ongoing debate about that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And you have two lawyers on interview today, on tap today. And they're talking about rape as well. And Goh Siew Lin is one of the first woman to be the chairman of the KL Bar.
Okay. Also, after the 9:30 news today, we have Joyce Goh Edge, and she speaks about several stories that she's written this week, including one in the latest issue of the Edge Weekly, Future Proofing Astro. So that's a story about the media.
That's right. This is, of course, about how challenged the media sector is by the rise of online entertainment and people, the phenomenon of cutting the cord, you know, people going directly to consume their entertainment. And so this is really about how Astro is going to deal with that. Although in the recent release of their results, Astro was pretty confident that there would be growth this year in 2017, this fiscal year. They're pretty positive about it, and they have identified a few areas to do that. I guess we'll be talking more about that with Joyce Goh.
Okay. Overnight, of course, we've had real developments globally, especially on the terror front. I mean, this is not happy news, but we had 44 dead when after attacks on two Coptic churches. The Copts are, I believe, kind of Eastern Orthodox Christians. They're about 10% of the Egyptian population. These attacks on them on Palm Sunday comes, you know, it's particularly
very sensitive time.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, I mean, any bombing of a church service
would be, but this is particularly,
it's been claimed by the Islamic State. They say they're behind the blast. And it's very interesting. You watch Twitter and you follow Twitter on this. You know, somebody wrote, and I was moved by this, and I put it up. It says, there's a widespread belief among cops that if they love Egypt hard enough, it will stop kicking them in the teeth. The violence against the cops has been going on for decades now, and it's just extraordinary, the, you know, the just the sheer intensity and brutality of the violence mm-hmm. against the Christian minority in Egypt.
And it's also a very, I guess, worrying development because of what happened over the weekend when the U.S. launched missiles into Syria. And it's really reflective of the complexity of that region. I mean, IS is in Syria as well. And there is this sort of proxy war that's going on over there that's very worrying because of its potential to escalate.
Absolutely. We'll be back with more news as Sweden and North Korea in the mix as well. We'll be right back. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. The Morning Run continues, and that was Ooh La La by The Faces. I'm sure it could end it with me, Julian Ng. Very quickly, Julian, there are just two bits of news probably worth sort of following up on because of Stockholm truck attack. We now know that the 39-year-old Uzbek man who is suspected to have been of driving the truck had his application for residency in Sweden rejected last June, and he was being sought by immigration officials. So perhaps part of the anger emanating from that rejection. Also in the North Korean peninsula, U.S. warships have been deployed there in what seems like escalating tensions. So, you know, remember just last week, North Korea launched some missiles into the, and it fell into the Sea of Japan. There, you know, the dictator Kim Jong-un demonstrating his military power. And I think in response, the U.S., of course, showing a bit of muscle as well. And also saying to the international community that if China doesn't contain North Korean aggression, then they will go at it alone and act unilaterally. So a lot mm-hmm. of tensions in the North Korean and South Korean peninsula, mm-hmm. or the Korean peninsula, as it were. But, you know, it was also very interesting, Julian, if you've been following that whole series of Tomahawk strikes on Syria. You know Farid Zakaria, who's, yes. you know, yeah, he came out and he said, finally, you know, Trump is acting like a president. And I was like appalled. I must admit, I was appalled.
Yeah, because I guess the history of it was back to the deal that Obama made with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad a few years ago and saying that America would not go to war with Syria if they destroy some of the chemical weapons that they had. And I think that some of it, President Bashir didn't do that, or some of it got, he cheated his way out of it and retained some of those weapons. And I think that what President Obama tried to do was to avert this attack, full-fledged attack into Syria at the time. But I think with Trump, there is this whole proxy war that's going on that he wants to get involved in, I guess, show his bravado to a certain degree as well.
Yeah, well, you know, and this is what I don't understand about. I mean, I know Syria is a very complex issue, but Farid Zakaria cheering on Trump and saying that this act of aggression made him presidential, and I thought was very revealing of a particular mindset that's very dominates a lot of people's minds, which is that, you know, that violence is the and sure power is what makes somebody a president, you mm-hmm, know, mm-hmm. Or somebody a leader. And I thought that was really kind of inadequate to the situation, because I think what Farid Zakaria, as somebody who's supposed to be an analyst and thinking about deeply about the world, is to ask, well, is this going to solve anything? And, you know, what exactly is a solution and a search for peace advanced by this particular action?
Yeah, so I wouldn't know how to solve that problem that's happening right there in Syria. And if you put me on there, I would be totally lost, right? Because as you say, the problem is so complex. But doesn't it boil down to a case of if I don't kill you, you will kill me, right? It kind of boils down to that, because this is so sectarian. And there is so much suspicion and distrust that's going on. Different sects of the Islamic religion, of Islam, And they are suspicious of each other. And this has erupted into a kind of proxy war that other countries are getting involved in. I mean, you're talking about Turkey and Iraq and Iran and Saudi Arabia, all representing their respective faction. So I don't know if peace is realistic. I wish it was.
Yeah, but the question, that might be true. But the question is then, what did the Tomahawk missile attack really do? Apart from showing that Trump is willing to do these things.
A lot of people believe it's, including very respected American politicians, believe that it's a kind of false flag to start a war spontaneously.
Well, on the North Korean issue, last week on Friday during the breakfast grill, we were talking about the very question of, the difference between America and China and their views of North Korea. And, professor, Dr. Lee from the Rajaratnam School in Singapore said, the difference is China doesn't want regime change and America wants regime change. And that's essentially what's driving a very different sort of, actions on the part of those two powers in the North Korean peninsula. So anyway, lots of complexities there. We will have to keep coming back to that, I think, over time, Julian. We do have a very interesting story, though, in the Business Insider. It's a story about how Warner Brothers might have to pay some $900 million if they can't prove ghosts are real. And that's such a clickbait type of headline. I had to read it.
I would totally click on it.
Yeah. And this has to do with the very successful Conjuring franchise, being sued by an author for $900 million. So the story is very simple. But you just mentioned earlier a Malaysian connection. I didn't know about this. I have watched one of the Conjuring films. Not
did you enjoy it?
No, I mean, I kind of
gave up.
Did it
make you believe that ghosts exist?
Never. And, I watch it just to look for style. And, I grew up on this stuff, Amityville horror. That was very popular in the early 80s. And all of them claiming to be true, And I always assumed that, films can make these claims about being true because nobody really believes necessarily that they're true. It doesn't matter whether it's true or it's completely fictitious.
Yeah, but so this lawsuit is very interesting because they are accusing the producers of Conjuring of stealing material, which apparently these other people have rights to. And the other side, the Conjuring people are arguing that this dispute is based on some kind of historical fact, right? And therefore, you can't have creative license. You can't own that part of the creativity. So these guys are saying, if you can prove that ghosts are real because you're pleading factual events, right, historical facts, right? Then we believe. And it reminds me of the case with the Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, which was made into the movie, but it was very close to another non-fiction book that was written along the same lines, and the authors of that book sued Dan Brown for plagiarism. But the judge ruled in favor of Dan Brown because he says that if you're writing something that's based on history, then you can't claim copyright over it because it's based on historical fact, and anyone can use that to their advantage.
Okay, so with The Conjuring, very quickly, it's actually based on so-called paranormal investigations by these two individuals, Ed and Lorraine Warren. And so Gerald Brittle, who's suing Warner Brothers, says that he wrote a book about the Warrens in 1980 called The Demonologist, and he had an agreement with the Warrens that they should never produce anything that he has ultimate right to over the story. And so when they went ahead with Warner Brothers to produce the movie, they, according to him, had breached this contract. And so in order to sue them, he had to find a way in, and he found the way in this claim to be factually based. And that's what this whole thing is about. And it'll be very interesting to see whether they can prove it true. But at any rate, it's still a little flag that we can fly because a Malaysian's involved.
There you go.
There you go. Next, we have the first bulletin of the day with Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run, and that was Sweet Home Alabama by Lynyrd Skynyrd. Good morning. I'm Sharad Kutin, and with me, Julian Ng, and it's now coming up to 40 minutes past six. We just put out a poll because after we went off air and it was an animated discussion about whether ghosts exist, you know, it was like...
And, spirited discussion.
Yeah, spirited. Yeah, very, very spirited. Ooh, good pun. Okay, so anyway, we put out a poll. Oh my goodness, there are already two votes come in.
Oh, wow.
Okay, do you believe ghosts exist? And we have five votes coming in.
What are the results?
Well,
I'm dying 40, to know.
40% say yes and 60% say no. Well, you know, it's still early days. Not early days. It's a 24-hour poll, so you can join the Twitter revolution right here on BFM 89.9. In fact, you can also tweet us at BFM Radio or WhatsApp us or text us at 016-201-9000. That's 016-201-9000. If you have any views on anything that we're talking about at any point in the day, and especially during the morning run, which runs from 6 to 10 a.m. So just tell us what you feel. If you take exception to what we say, please tell us, and we'll discuss it. Wow, we're up to 9 votes now on this. Julian, do you believe in ghosts?
No, I don't.
Okay.
No, I don't.
But whose responsibility is it to prove that there are no ghosts? So is it the responsibility of people who believe in ghosts to prove that ghosts exist? Or is it the people who are skeptical who have to then say, well, prove that ghosts don't exist?
I don't know. I think it's more curiosity than responsibility. I think that if any scientists out there embark on trying to research on ghosts, it would be more out of curiosity. Because I don't think there is a purpose for this, whether to prove whether it exists or not. What is the end goal of this?
Well, yeah, I think some people who are spiritual, you know, for whom the real world consists of many levels of reality, will say, you know, it science is inadequate in understanding everything that exists, you know, as it were, and so we need other frameworks and other lenses to kind of understand what reality is. And so for them, a ghost, you know, after all, if you believe in the soul or a soul, then a ghost is a natural progression in that belief system, isn't it?
Yeah, I think for a lot of people who believe in ghosts and the spiritual world, science is a temporal thing, isn't it? Because it's not that it's inadequate, and perhaps it's inadequate, but it hasn't, they would argue that science hasn't found the means to prove a spiritual world exists.
Yeah, because they're using different tools. So the science is not set up to be able to prove these things, including, say, the existence of God.
Yeah.
By the way, we have 20 votes, and it's now tipped in favor of the yeses. So 65% of you believe that ghosts exist, and 35% say you don't.
And this reminds me of recent news that we read and we covered as well, that some of the scientists involved in the Hadron Collider, that I don't understand the science behind a Hadron Collider. I think it's trying to get to the bottom of the Big Bang Theory and how the world started and the meaning of life even. One of the scientists from there said that because the Hadron Collider can't detect any activity, he doesn't believe that ghosts exist. And he says that the Hadron Collider has proven that ghosts actually don't exist.
Well, yeah, I'm not aware of that research, and I'm not quite sure if...
No, it's not a research. It was just an
opinion.
Comment by one of the
okay.
scientists. Yeah,
yeah, you know, I don't think it'll satisfy those who do believe, because these belief systems, you know, really don't depend on sort of material evidence to, because there's always anecdotes, and this is why I think paranormal stories are very interesting, because they always allude to them being factual, right? So it's like, like, oh my goodness, we've believed in ghosts. How come nobody's ever caught one? You always see these images, but half the time they're faked. And, you know, and so that kind of thing happened. But I think curiosity really does push people to want to know more. And that's why there's an endless fascination with, the spiritual realm or the realm of ghosts.
So would
ghouls.
You dare go ghost hunting, Sharad? Like, would you dare...
It's a futile thing. I'll never get anything. Nobody's ever caught
one. If you were challenged to stay overnight in a cemetery, for example, would you dare do it, or would you be scared?
I had absolutely no problems. I mean,
really?
I think my only fear would be like couples.
So here's the thing, right?
So making out, which is probably what the best use of cemeteries, I think, at night. You know.
So here's I don't know of any couples who seek out to go to cemeteries to do that thing. But you know, if I were asked to do the same thing, I think I would be scared, and I think I attribute this to a kind of historical, cultural conditioning in me, in my mind, even though I don't believe in ghosts. But I would be actually scared to do that, although it would not stop me from sort of trying. But that doesn't mean I wouldn't be scared. I would be so spooked out.
You know, I, as a child, I love ghost stories. I love to be... And my aunt would tease me even to this day. You know, they're in the 80s and they remind me how much I love ghost stories and how scared I would be that if I had to have a bath, because, you know, before you go to sleep, you have to have a bath. I would ask my aunt...
If you didn't, the ghost would come look for you.
Yeah, no, I'm not. No, they didn't say that. But, you know, I'd be terrified and I'd say, could you be by the door? So, I mean, I was like, you know, 6 or 7 or whatever it is. But I love the feeling of being frightened.
Yes.
I think that's the other appeal, right? People love being frightened.
So you love ghost stories as well?
I gave up on that. You know, I think by the time I became a teenager, it didn't provide any kind of fascination for me. I'm much more interested in science. I think science has got enough to keep you curious and excited. I don't think you really need...
But you know, the interesting thing is when science and the spiritual world collide. I think many people are interested in that realm, you know, where science, the spiritual world reveals itself in an almost pseudo real science kind of way. And I think that's what people go after. And even when you talk about science fiction, I mean, when you go onto platforms like Netflix, for example, sometimes the lines are very blur between what is the horror genre and what is the science fiction genre, right? Because we like to escape into this other world.
You know what I find really scary is little Korean girls who sweep their hair over their faces. I think that's really scary.
And all the
ways in which cinematographers and directors keep you scared is a sudden, a burst of anything, or you have in the, you know, in the foreground somebody talking.
Ringu.
And then somebody passes behind.
Yeah, that's probably one of the scariest ghost stories around Ringu. Yeah, the Japanese.
Yeah, and so you know, the whole thing is about pressing buttons. So it's I love the fact that I could be made scared, even though I don't believe any of it, but I get absorbed into the world and there's these cinematic tricks that really... And
which is why I don't believe that you're not going to be spooked out if you had to stay overnight in a cemetery.
Yeah, of course, you know, I mean... Now, I do want to mention again James Wan, the Malaysian-born, Kuching-born, Australian.
We're claiming him as Malaysian.
Yeah, he's done so well. He's done extraordinarily well in Hollywood.
Started a Saw franchise.
Yeah,
right?
But see, that's horror, but not ghosts and scary in that way. It's just
thriller. That's more of a thriller.
It's gruesome.
Where you
got to
cut off limbs
to escape. I think that is just disgusting. I mean, I really don't think it was very clever.
Saw, the earlier Saws at least were very clever.
Well, okay, you know, we have like 35 votes have come in on the ghost poll. It's a real poll, but it's about ghostly
It's not
things.
An apparition. Sharad actually started this poll.
Yeah. 71% of you say that you believe that ghosts exist, and 29% say. So the skeptics are losing out in this poll. At least there are fewer skeptics than there are believers. So, well, we'll have to leave you with that. The link on that Twitter is to the Warner Brothers story. So, you know, you might want to read that because that's real. You know, it's a legal suit, and there's nothing unreal about $900 million.
You can't pay that with hell money, hell notes.
You can't. Anyway, coming up next is the news, and here's "It Ain't Over Till It's Over" by Lenny Kravitz, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.